This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From Japan and then Ecuador, when major earthquakes strike, the media rush to Dr. William McGuire. He's a volcanologist and world-known specialist in extreme geologic events. McGuire is Emeritus Professor of Geophysical and Climate Hazards at University College London. Bill has advised the UK government on global threats and appears often on TV. Bill was also an author of the 2011 report of the IPCC regarding extreme events. His latest book is Waking the Giant, How a Changing Climate Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. Bill, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
What is your recent take on the big quakes in Japan and Ecuador?
Well, to be honest, it's really just business as usual. I mean, these are not gigantic quakes. We would expect up to a dozen of earthquakes of this sort of size every year. So it's really nothing unusual. I mean, you see stress and strain accumulating on faults all over the planet all the time. And periodically, that results in a fault rupturing and an earthquake of this sort of size.
Are we entering a more intense geologic period, or do we just have better reporting and more cell phone videos?
Well, that's the thing these days, isn't it, that disasters and disastrous events are in the news sort of immediately. Everybody, none of these things can happen without people seeing them or filming them these days. We do have a variation in the numbers of earthquakes that happen every year and the number of volcanic eruptions that happen every year, but it's within the statistical noise, if you like. There's no, not yet anyway, there's no obvious increase in either volcanic activity or earthquake activity. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our changing environment, that climate change isn't triggering certain events. It's just that we're not sure which ones those are, and we can't detect them against the general background of activity.
Right. You did put in your book, Waking the Giant, that climate change could possibly stimulate more activity from volcanoes. I have a hard time understanding how that's possible. How does it work?
Well, it's something that we've known for a long time by looking back in time. And it's there are a number of ways this can happen. One of them is where you have volcanoes that are loaded by a great thickness of ice. You have in Iceland today, and as you had right across Iceland, for example, in the past, when that load of ice melts, when it's removed, magma that's been unable to get out when the ice was sitting there can get out more easily. Also, if you take the weight of the ice away, you actually produce more magma underneath the crust in the Earth's mantle as well. That's one way we can do it. We can also do it in the case of volcanoes that are coastally located or form islands by changing sea level. If you change sea level dramatically, either up or down, then it creates quite big changes in stress and strain in the crust that can push magma out. So there's a number of ways this can happen.
What about the melting of ice, say, in Iceland that seems to be capping over some volcanoes?
Well, that is a big concern. If we go back something like 12,000 years, or go back 20,000 years, the height of the last ice age, Iceland was covered by a kilometre of ice, and that weight stopped virtually all volcanic activity. But when the ice melted, around about 12,000 years ago, there was almost a real what's called a volcano storm. The rate of volcanic activity went up 50 times over a course of about 1,500 years. Now, Iceland isn't covered by a kilometre of ice today, but there is this big ice cap, the Vatnajökull ice cap in the east, and that is melting very, very rapidly. And modelling that's been undertaken suggests that as that melts, so we will see an increase in the amount of lava coming out and also in the amount of lava that's being produced underneath the crust. So, I mean, it's certain for a start that ice cap will melt because of the rate the temperature's rising, and we will see a measurable increase in volcanic activity. And we know, obviously, from the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010, that just one moderate eruption on Iceland can create total chaos across the aviation industry.
And here is the question everyone asks you. Bill McGuire, do you think climate change is a contributing cause to the recent great quakes from Nepal to Japan?
Well, that's an interesting question. In terms of the Japanese earthquake, there was a recent Japanese earthquake and the one in Ecuador, there's no particular reason why we should think climate change was involved in that. The same really goes for the Nepal earthquakes, although there is a mechanism, a climate mechanism for triggering earthquakes in the Nepal region. And it's only been really discovered quite recently that when you have monsoon rainfall, That monsoon rainfall soaks into the sediment in the Ganges Plain right across the front of the Himalayas, and it compresses the faults there. And it seems that that compression is causing more earthquakes to happen in the winter months along the Himalayan, what we call the Himalayan front, than the rest of the year. So if you have a change in the monsoon, for example, as a result of climate change, then you may see some change in the controlling of earthquakes in the Himalayas. But the Nepal earthquake, the specific earthquake that happened in April last year, we don't have any direct evidence for a climate link. But then again, as I said, we may not necessarily see that.
You know, people are concerned with climate change, and we should be, but some of us have a hard time believing these latest quakes are not. Everything has to be connected to climate, but there must be a point where your theory does really kick in earnest. Do we know when that might be?
The thing is, all different faults that generate earthquakes right across the planet will be in different states of stress and strain. Some will be ready to go, ready to rupture, ready to generate big earthquakes. Others might have ruptured recently, and they may take centuries to accumulate enough strain to rupture again. Now, in terms of climate change, in terms of the stress and strain induced by the loss of ice, by rising sea levels, the faults that are going to be affected are those ones that are critically poised and ready to rupture to generate an earthquake. And all that's needed there is literally the pressure of a handshake to set those off. So those faults that are ready to go are the ones that are going to be affected. Now, we may not see an increase in the total number of earthquakes across the world, but you only need one or two major faults in built-up areas and urban areas that are ready to go. Only a few of those faults to be triggered by climate change, and you will have a massive impact.
What caused that great quake and tsunami off the coast of Japan in 2011?
That was simply tectonic stresses. In other words, the world's tectonic plates pushing against one another, accumulating stress and strain over a long period of time, and then rupturing, as they do every few hundred years in most cases, and generating a big tsunami. I mean, that earthquake was a submarine earthquake. Now, if you think about one of the triggers for earthquakes relating to climate change, is to do with sea level. But in those cases, as sea level goes up and the load of the water increases and increases, it will stabilize those submarine faults. They will tend to rupture probably less often. The faults that we should worry about are faults like the San Andreas that are parallel to a coastline, because where sea level rises there, next to those faults, it will bend them. It will bend one side of the fault and not the other, and that can allow them to move more easily. So we shouldn't be too concerned about submarine faults, but we should be a lot more concerned about faults that run across the land parallel to the ocean.
But I think this is one really important point you make, Bill. Because of tsunamis, listeners do not have to live in an earthquake zone themselves to suffer the consequences. Could you tell us about another couple of tsunamis, either in human history or the geologic record?
Well, extraordinarily, we've had two catastrophic tsunamis, as I'm sure all your listeners will know, the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 and then Japan in 2011. That's really unprecedented to see them occur so frequently. But if we go back in the past, there's evidence of massive tsunamis right across the planet, not just in the Pacific. I think one of the most interesting formed about 8,000 years ago as a result of climate change, because after the ice sheets that covered Scandinavia, Norway and Sweden, started to melt, the crust underneath there started to bounce back up very, very rapidly because of the weight of the ice had disappeared. That triggered lots of big earthquakes. One of those big earthquakes triggered a gigantic landslide off the coast of Norway, one of the biggest known on the planet. That generated a tsunami which was up to 30 meters high in the north of Scotland. It came right down the North Sea into Western Europe, and it went straight across the Atlantic towards North America as well. Now, it's that sort of thing that we're worried about for the future, because Greenland is in a very similar situation to Scandinavia at the end of the last ice age. 2 or 3 kilometers of ice. That ice is melting already. The crust is already bouncing back up under Greenland. We know that from GPS measurements. If that uplift causes earthquakes, if those earthquakes trigger big submarine landslides, then we could see tsunamis in the North Atlantic again.
And there's a YouTube video where you introduce four major threats, and that's from another of your books, Global Catastrophe, a very short introduction. Could you just outline what those four threats are?
Yes, there's four really big natural threats, which I call global geophysical events, or GGs. There's the asteroid or comet impact, there's a volcanic super eruption, there's what I call a strategic earthquake, an earthquake that occurs somewhere that affects one of the big financial centers and therefore has a knock-on effect across the planet in terms of employment and jobs and economy and politics and this sort of thing. Tokyo is really the place I think of when I talk about that. And then the fourth one is a giant ocean-wide tsunami, particularly in the North Atlantic. And obviously the place I've been working for some time now is on the Canary Island of La Palma, where you have this huge mass of rock which is unstable and at some point in the future will collapse into the North Atlantic and generate a major tsunami. Now, that could threaten tens of millions of people around the margins of the Atlantic in North America and also in Europe. So those are the four things, really: super eruption, asteroidal comet impact, giant tsunami, and strategic earthquake.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Bill McGuire. He's the well-known UK expert on extreme geophysical hazards like earthquakes and volcanoes and even climate change. Yeah, you've talked about Tokyo as a city waiting to die. That's pretty extreme talk. Tell us more.
Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, not literally, I don't think. But Tokyo is in one of the most seismically active parts of the planet. In the 1920s, there was a catastrophic earthquake there which killed maybe up to 200,000 people. The fires after the earthquake wiped out much of the city. Now, today, Tokyo's population is several times bigger than that. It's something like 36 million people, extraordinary size. It's one of the major economic and financial centers on the planet. The big earthquake in 2011 in Japan actually stressed some of the faults that might affect Tokyo in the future and brought forward the timing of the next large earthquake to affect Tokyo. So it's, you know, it is sitting there on a number of big faults which are pretty much ready to go. There are a huge number of people. Many of the buildings are well constructed and will withstand the earthquake, but there are over a million wooden buildings as well, which burn very, very easily and which can trigger, again, some of these huge fires that caused problems in the 1920s quake. So it's, you know, it is a big worry, certainly.
You know, I've got a quote here, Bill, from a not always reliable source. I'd like to check it with you. It says, scientists at Tokyo University estimate there is a 98% chance that in the next 30 years, Japan will be hit by an earthquake equivalent to that great Kanto of 1923. Seismologists at the Japan Meteorological Agency, however, put the odds of this happening at 70%. Does that sound about right to you?
Does, yes. You know, whether you're talking 70 or 90, that is a very, very high percentage in the next couple of decades. And it really illustrates the point that I think along with Istanbul in Turkey, Tokyo is one of the two most threatened cities in terms of a coming big earthquake.
And our financial system sometimes seems like a house of cards. It wouldn't take too much for one of these big cities to go down, even if it was Los Angeles, and then the whole world economy could be damaged.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the global economy ever since 1928 has really not recovered at all, and it's clearly on edge all the time. And one of these big earthquakes, one of these strategic earthquakes in the wrong place could just, as you point out, cause things to collapse like a house of cards. I mean, I get the impression that the stock markets and the currency markets are really just waiting for something to happen before they just fall apart.
And I've also talked with seismologists who are deeply worried about fault lines near nuclear power plants or the many reactors perched on the edge of the sea within tsunami range. Have you looked into that?
It's not an area that I look at in particular, but as a general point, the whole issue with nuclear power is that most power stations are coastally located. And at times of where we're going to see significant rise in sea level, that is not a good place to have these things. I mean, sea level could easily be 2 meters higher by the end of the century. In addition to that, the oceans are warming, and of course, reactors need cooling water, so they suffer if temperatures are much higher, if heat waves happen. Sometimes they have to be closed down, as has happened in the past. So, you know, notwithstanding a specific tsunami threat from earthquakes, just rising sea levels is going to be a big problem for nuclear power plants that are on the coast.
Now, Bill McGuire, if you are advising a government on prioritizing spending, should it be on preparing for catastrophic geologic events, as we've been discussing, or to slash greenhouse gas emissions? What's your take?
I think it has to be climate change. We are in a dreadful situation, despite the Paris conference last December and all the backslapping and all the congratulations. I really don't think that's come up with anything firm whatsoever. Even if all the countries actually do what they say they're going to do in terms of reducing emissions, we've still got, in my opinion, and many other climate scientists, no chance of avoiding catastrophic climate change. So that has to be the priority. It really does. Things like asteroid impacts, things like super eruptions, these are certain to happen again. There's no doubt about that. But they have long return periods, 50,000 years with a super eruption, a 1 kilometer asteroid, maybe 500,000 years. So you know, they will happen. We should be concerned about them. But climate change is here now. It's happening now. We must do something about it. We must take serious action now.
You know, I've lived for years in quake-prone cities like Vancouver and Los Angeles, and I experienced the deadly L.A. quake in 1971. But I have to say, for the average person just trying to pay the bills, is there anything we can do to prepare, or should we just go on about our lives hoping it doesn't happen?
Well, you know, this is what we do, isn't it? This is what most people do, is go on about their lives hoping it won't happen to them or thinking it won't happen to them. It shouldn't really be down to individuals to concern themselves with these massive geological problems, things like super eruptions or asteroid impacts, whatever, because they are very infrequent. Even governments, although they need to pay attention to these, can't devote vast sums of money to trying to cope with them. What we need to do is to hope that we'll get warning signs. I mean, no volcano erupts without warning signs. We've spotted most of the big asteroids now, for example, out there, and we've got some good monitoring systems in place. So we would hope that we would see these things in time and be able to take measures then. But I don't want everybody to be locking themselves in a bunker with several hundred tins of baked beans or anything like that. And don't lose too much sleep over it, I would say.
What, it's safe for me to come out and not eat beans anymore?
Yes, I think beans is probably the wrong thing to have in a bunker in large quantities. but, you know, we can't afford to take this attitude to climate change. Climate change is absolutely critical, and it's the biggest threat to our race. If we burn all the fossil fuels or substantial proportion of fossil fuels, then the average temperature of our planet could be 30 degrees centigrade instead of what it is now, 14. Now, that physiologically, humans cannot exist under those conditions. That would see a mass dieback, a mass extinction of most of our race. And that's the bottom line.
Right. Have you got another book in the works or a TV series planned?
I've been thinking about this for a while, and I've sort of taken a slight change of tack, and I'm now working on a couple of fiction novels, young adult novels, looking at which involve a climate change component. I'm trying my hand at that at the moment. I'm finding it a lot more difficult than writing popular science, I must admit. But at some point, something may come out. You never know.
And listeners can get a free new short story you've written called Incoming, about climate change and mass migration, at your website at billmaguire.co.uk. As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to add?
Being Vancouver there, obviously, you have got a bit of a seismic risk. We have got the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami problem, which is something which will happen at some point in the future. So although talking in general about people and saying, you know, don't worry too much about these things, clearly if you live in a zone like that, an earthquake zone, you do need to pay attention to what the authorities are telling you about how to prepare for earthquakes and tsunamis. So just keep safe, really.
Okay, we've been talking with British Professor William Maguire. He's the author of books on extreme global threats and has advised the UK government. And if you can only read one Maguire book, I recommend Waking the Giant, How Climate Change Triggers Earthquakes, Tsunamis, and Volcanoes. I'll put links to Bill and his work in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Bill Maguire, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.